I'm going that way, so I don't go down Beale.
Good morning. Hey. It is 9:30. This is the appointed hour. And could we do the roll?
On the roll for the Stationary Source Committee meeting of December 16th, 2019, Director Bowders.
Here.
Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Joya.
Here.
Director Groom. Director Miley. Director Ross.
Here.
Director Sparing. Director Wagenknecht.
Here.
Director Wilson. Committee Vice Chair Mitchoff.
Here.
Committee Chair Sinks.
Thank you. I'm here.
We have a quorum.
Let's stand for the pledge. Mark, would you lead us?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Did I get a merit badge for that?
We will give you a merit badge.
I will point out that the flag is a military tribunal flag.
What?
If it has the fringe around it, it's technically a military tribunal flag.
Oh. Oh, well, that changes the nature of this meeting, I guess.
I know that because a citizen sued.
Really?
A citizen sued our city and said everything we had done was illegal because we had a military tribunal flag.
We have a city where they cost the mayor, that's right.
Yes.
Where they do what?
Anyway.
The things you learn in public service. Marcy, do we have any public speakers?
Not for this item.
Thank you. So... we're on to item 3, approval of the minutes of September 16th. Do I have a motion?
I'll second it.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstained? Thank you. Item 4, today we're going to get an update on Reg 6, Rule 18, our all-important toxins rule, and how we're doing on implementing that.
Good morning, Chair Sinks and members of the committee. This morning, we're going to give you a little bit of an update on 1118, as you'd mentioned. We've spent a lot of time over the last year getting the information that we need for this particular program and putting the mechanics in place to get these health risk assessments done. Today, you'll hear that we have kind of moved out of the data gathering phase into the actual execution of the health risk assessments themselves, which is exciting. And then we plan in the first quarter of next year to actually begin with the issuance of the public versions of the health risk assessments and then moving into the planning phase. So today, Carol Allen, the assistant manager who's been leading this effort and leading it very successfully, will give us the update on the program.
Thank you. Welcome, Karen. Carol.
Thank you, Damien. Yeah. Good morning, Chair Sinks and members of the Stationary Source Committee. I'm here today to provide you with an update on Regulation 11, Rule 18. This is our toxic risk reduction rule for existing facilities. This morning, I'm going to review the requirements of the rule, discuss our implementation process for the rule, and our current status, and then I'll go over our next steps. Regulation 11, Rule 18, was adopted on November 15, 2017. The purpose of this rule is to ensure that facilities that emit toxic air contaminants do not pose an unacceptable risk to students, residents, or workers nearby. A facility-wide health risk assessment is necessary to determine if Regulation 11, Rule 18 applies to a facility. If the HRA finds that a health risk from a facility exceeds a risk action level, the facility is subject to this rule and must comply with the risk reduction requirements. This table shows the risk action levels for the rule. The 2020 risk action levels will become effective on January 1st. Any facility that's found to have a health risk above a risk action level must submit a risk reduction plan to the Air District for our approval. The risk reduction plan must show that the facility will either reduce all health risks below the 2020 risk action levels or provide controls for all sources that have a significant health risk. The facility will have 5 years to implement the approved risk reduction plan, and in between, the facility must submit annual progress reports. The implementation process for this rule can be broken down into the five major steps here. In step one, the Air District determines which facilities will be required to have an updated health risk assessment. The screening process uses the facility's prioritization score, which is calculated annually. Gasoline dispensing facilities and emergency backup engines are exempt from this rule unless the prioritization score is very high. In step two, the engineering staff collect and update toxic emission inventories, stack parameters, and other data that we need to conduct the health risk assessment. These inventory corrections may result in an HRA being no longer required if the prioritization score drops low enough. In step three, the Air District conducts or approves a health risk assessment. Both the facility and the public will have an opportunity to provide comments on the draft HRA before it is finalized. If a health risk assessment exceeds a risk action level, we move on to the final steps. In step four, the facility submits a draft risk reduction plan, and the Air District reviews and approves these plans. In step five, the facility implements the approved risk reduction measures. As I mentioned earlier, the Air District uses prioritization scores to classify facilities. We calculate a prioritization score for each site during the annual permit renewal process. The scores are based on toxic emission inventory data for the site and health effects data for the toxic compounds that are emitted. The sites with the highest prioritization scores are phase one sites, and the remaining are classified as phase two. We now have 36 phase one sites. We just added one more site, Schnitzer Steel, a shredding operation in West Oakland, to our list of phase one facilities. Other phase one sites include landfill and composting operations, chemical and manufacturing plants, energy plants, refineries, and a crematory. The phase two sites include energy facilities, semiconductors, medical centers, universities, wastewater treatment processes, crematories, coffee roasters, food manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, and more landfills. In late 2018 and throughout 2019, we began collecting and updating toxic emissions data from the phase one facilities. As I mentioned, we just added Schnitzer Steel to our phase one list, and we are preparing the initial data request for this facility now. Most of the data from the refineries was received in September, but some of their inventory data is still unavailable. Data has been received from all the other phase one sites. We've completed the data review and validation process for four sites. A facility-wide health risk assessment is required for all four of these sites. And I am pleased to report that we have completed our first preliminary health risk assessment. It was sent to the site, Irvington Memorial Cemetery, in November for the required 90-day facility review period. Facility comments are due on February 19, 2020. The preliminary results indicate that this facility will be required to submit a risk reduction plan. This is our updated implementation schedule for the phase one facilities. As shown here in red, we are in steps two and three for the phase one facilities. Once the Air District has completed the preliminary HRA, the facility is given the 90 days to review and provide comments. The district will make any necessary corrections before the draft HRA is made available to the public. We expect to post the first draft HRA to the website in March 2020 for Irvington Memorial Cemetery. We expect to send the preliminary HRAs to Owens Corning Insulating Systems and the City of Santa Clara in January, and to Los Medanos Energy Center in February. The draft HRAs for these sites should be posted to the website by June 2020. The next three sites that will be undergoing HRA are FXI, Genentech, and ABNI. Most draft HRAs for Phase 1 facilities will be posted to the website by mid-2021. Draft HRAs for the refinery should be posted by the end of 2021. After considering comments and making any necessary changes to the draft HRA, the Air District will post the final HRA and notify the site in writing if a risk reduction plan is required. The facility will then have 6 months to submit the plan. The plan approval process takes about a year. Once the Air District approves the risk reduction plan, the facility has 5 years to implement the risk reduction measures. So this is our next steps for the implementation. Our immediate next steps are to post the guidance documents that we're currently finalizing. Additional website updates are underway that will allow the public to sign up for Rule 1118 notifications. We're designing the web page for the Rule 1118 HRAs and risk reduction plans, where they'll be posted to invite public comment. And meanwhile, the district staff will continue to complete our data validation process for the remaining Phase 1 sites and continue conducting the HRAs. Consultants under the supervision of the Air District staff will be engaged to conduct HRAs for some of the largest facilities, such as refineries. And we expect to start preparing that request for proposal process next year, early next year. This concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Question.
Director Jaya.
Just a timing question. So the large facilities like the refineries, the process you're saying is a consultant preparing the HRA under the guidance of the district staff.
That's correct. We will be going through a review and approval process of a modeling protocol that identifies all of the steps that that consultant will take in order to complete that health risk assessment with them before they engage in the HRA, and then we'll go into the HRA process.
And the timing, are they going to be prepared at the same time, or not sequentially, or they're going to overlap? In other words, there'll be different consultants preparing different HRAs for different large facilities.
That is exactly
so
what
not
I'm expecting.
One, is one consultant,
not one consultant doing all of them, but I'm expecting different consultants for different facilities because we need to make sure that there's no conflict of interest.
Right. So how's the timing being done? There's five refineries. Are they being done at the same time? What are they overlapped? How is that being done?
The review is still underway of the data right now, so we don't have a set schedule for uh-huh. each of the refineries. I think it kind of depends a little bit on our RFP process and when those consultants are going to be available and what that timing
right.
is going to
be. So you're not doing them, just want to be clear, you're not doing them sequentially. You're doing them
We'll be going out for those RFPs at the same time.
Yeah, our intention is to do them concurrently as best we can. There's still some holes in the data that we need to complete. Some of the data is dependent on our heavy liquid study and the results and factors there, and we are currently validating kind of emission points data. The staff does all of that. Then all that information is transferred to the consultants, and our intention is to do them concurrently as quickly as we can.
Director Wagenknecht.
Thank you. So you've sort of answered, I think you've answered my first question was going to be that there's a big gulp of them that we're validating their data right now, 31 facilities, and that's a bunch of them, so we're going to be doing how we're going to get with that is by hiring doing an RFP and doing that. Are there any of those 31 facilities that we expect could fall out of being required for an HRA at that?
There are actually some landfill facilities. There's a group of 13 landfill and composting facilities. That's kind of next on the list after the couple that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And some of those are older closed landfills. We do expect probably a couple of those will drop out when we do the emission inventory update process. Those facilities were using concentration data that was for the emission factors that came from EPA data. And we found that that data really overestimates the concentrations of toxics that we find in landfills that have been closed for a while.
Oh, I see.
And so we have a handful of landfills that have been closed for a while, and we do expect that those will probably drop out of this process. So there may be maybe five facilities that drop out.
Okay, so we probably still have...
We still have 30 or so that are still going to be in.
Thank you.
Questions on this side?
No.
I was curious, and I think the public might be interested in some of these facilities are lesser known to all of us in the Bay Area. They're not the refineries, not the cement plant, and so forth. Is it that the large industrial facilities like refineries are big enough that you just need more time, so they're at the end of the phase one list when they come to fruition?
So just to give you a little scope, some of these facilities have five sources or so. Mm-hmm. Some of them have 30 or 40 sources. Some of them in the 50 to 100 sources. The refineries and a couple of the largest chemical plants have more than 200 sources at mm-hmm. them. And so it is a matter of scale, but it's also the refineries, we're coordinating this through the 1215 process. The emission inventory review that's being done for 1215 will also feed into the emissions data that we use for the health risk assessments.
Okay, so you're looking for some data from 1215.
Yeah. Right, until that process is fully completed, we won't be able to start the HRAs for the refineries.
And you'll be able to do a better job of it for that 1215 data.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we're not doing any work on them. We are reviewing stack data and trying to get all of that information. And there's a whole nother set of emission inventories. The 1215 emission inventory is the annual emission inventory. The HRAs also require an hourly emission inventory, a max hourly emission inventory. And we're working on those with the refineries as well. We've had several meetings with them so far.
And in the work you've done thus far, in the facilities you're looking at, what are the compounds that fall in that somewhere between 10 and 100 range?
So the crematory that we've completed the health risk assessment for, the particular pollutants of concern were arsenic and hexavalent chromium for cancer risk and mercury for non-cancer. One of the other facilities that we're working on is City of Santa Clara Energy Plant. Nickel emissions are actually the risk driver for that facility. We have another facility, FXI, where the pollutant of concern is toluene diisocyanate.
I was thinking that was it.
Yeah. So it's kind of
an odd mix of things. For refineries, we expect it's probably going to be benzene and formaldehyde that drive the risk.
So I think, you know, as a bottom line answer, it depends on the processes that are occurring at the facility, and the drivers will be varied across the even across the facilities in the same category. So even at the refineries, some of the same compounds may drive the risk, but it's because of the proximity of the sources to the receptors prevailing wind conditions and locations, those are some of the factors. So that means that even at refinery facilities, some of the risk drivers may be different.
Yeah. Quite interesting. When do you think you're going to get to the cement plant, and what do you expect to find?
The Lehigh is going to be in the next group of facilities after that one that I listed. We have the landfills that I mentioned. There's about 13 of those. And then we have another group of about six or eight facilities that we are working on and hoping to finish up the data review for those first quarter next year. So those will be starting probably in, we'll probably have something in late summer next year.
Okay, thank you.
Lehigh's in that next group, yeah.
Of interest to people in my particular community. Thank you for your great work, Carol.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Anybody, any other questions? Do we have any members of the public?
Two.
Thank you.
Jed Holtzman and Sarah Greenwald.
All right.
Thank you. I'm going to present a bit of an alternate perspective, and I'm sorry I have to do this. I've actually rarely been more frustrated than this at this agency. This rule was adopted in 2017, over 2 years ago. Obviously, you knew the rule was coming for quite a while before that. It took 7 months to do the preliminary screening, and the preliminary screening came up with 36 facilities. 18 months after the screening, you have completed one HRA, and three more are in progress out of 36. Your staff report for this meeting indicated that most of them would be posted by the end of 2020, which was already, I think, a year delay from the presentation you received in March. Today, just a week after your staff report was published, you were now just presented that the HRAs will be mostly posted in mid-2021 with the refineries at the end of 2021. So that's 1 year past your staff report for this item, and I think 2 years beyond what you heard in March. And if I weren't here to tell you that, that would have just gone completely right by. And I think it's dishonest for your staff not to present those shifting timelines. This is only the HRAs that we are talking about. At that point, you actually need to develop the risk reduction plan, get that approved, and at that point, you actually have to spend years actually trying to reduce the emissions. And if it's not successful at the end of that 5 years, they get another 5-year extension go at it. What year do you think we're talking about at this point? No community who needs these toxic reductions can afford the kind of snooze fest that we are talking about here. The Air District continues to report this rule as something they've done to reduce emissions to you, and you all nod and smile, and some of you say that you should get pats on the back for all the great work you've done. I don't think you can honestly report this until it's actually reducing emissions, which your staff is telling you is unlikely to happen until the 2023 to 2027 timeline. That's only given the time shifts and lags that have occurred heretofore. We are talking about 2030 as this big marker for GHGs and all sorts of other things, for PM. We're basically getting there in round one of this, round one, from a 2017 rule. And you guys are talking about at the Advisory Council treating PM as a toxic. That's going to be the huge innovation to get at PM emissions. Let me tell you what we can afford with PM is treating it like this. 10 years to even get at the first round of emission reductions to see if we're even going to get anywhere. Thank you for the additional time.
Thank you. The next speaker.
Yes, thank you. I'm terribly disappointed, as Jed just pointed out, that this has been in the waiting for 2 years. So little has happened, and so little is likely to happen. When I look at the situation that the Earth is facing right now from climate change. So what's happened in this agency is that we put forward a proposal to cap refinery emissions. That went away. The governor basically turned it down. You no longer have the authority to control CO2. And so, you know, the next best thing is what you can do to control PM, which is a copollutant with CO2. And if this process that's going through the advisory council right now is going to go the same path as what's happening with 1118, then it's simply not going to work to treat PM as a toxic, because everything is stalled, and the public really expects better. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Sarah Greenwald. I hardly know what to say. I look at that 2028 end line here. That's very distressing. It really is. I hardly know what to suggest, but a great deal more haste is needed. Richard mentioned that this is directed toward PMs, which are a great health risk. And, either way you look at it, lives are at stake. And if you look at it in terms of CO2, I don't need to remind you what is at stake. So, I don't know what to suggest, but I do know that I do have the right to demand a great deal more haste.
Thank you. Are we done with public comment on this? Okay, thank you. I'll bring it back up here for our questions or comments. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My silence wasn't a factor that I wasn't concerned. So I do want to bring it up now. I know that we've talked a lot about doing this, and I'm looking at these timelines, why it's 18 months and for the health risk assessment, and why it's 18 months for the risk reduction plans. And I see where the Air District is involved, and I see where the site is involved. Does the Air District need more staff? And you can come back with a response to that, because I know there's a lot going on, but I'm just looking right now at, I guess it's slide 10, the data review, 7 months. The Air District sends data requests to site. I'd like more information. That's 30 days. What is that? From the date we send it to allow them that they've received it within 30 days, and then they have another 60 to 120 days to add and correct data. I think we do need to tighten up these timelines. I know this is sort of our first go at it, so to speak, but I do find these timelines to be way on the outside. So the question again is, do we need more staff at the Air District in order to be on top of this? And I do believe, and perhaps this needs to go back for further refinement, for how long it takes, or why we're allowing 2 to 4 months just on this first go-round for sites to add and correct data. I understand what you said, Carol. Some sites have 200 sources, and I get that. But I have an expectation of these sites that they're on top of that also. And I just think that is a long time. I know you sat down and talked with the industry, but I think there needs to be another conversation, because that's just too long. There's no other way to say that. Then when the draft HRA comes in and the Air District completes the preliminary, I know we've got consultants, but again, that 60 to 90 days, that may not be unreasonable, but the site reviews preliminary HRA, you know, 90 days, maybe we need to look at some sort of stratification, if that's the right word, for a site that has 50 sources or less, 10 sources or less, and those that are more, and put it in that kind of context that a site that doesn't have as many sources should get their response in sooner than that. I'm just putting this out to staff for you all to think about. I think we do, and I haven't even touched on the risk reduction plans, but my comments would still be the same. And I know we had a conversation about the site having the 5 years to implement, but maybe we need a little bit more conversation about that. So those are my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. On this side, Director Bowders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I have questions for staff, which is, what do you, in response to the public comment, what do you have currently that you might perceive as a barrier to accelerating the timeline in light of those comments?
Well, in terms of the, when we get to the end of the process, that there are requirements that are actually written into the rule that you adopted for facility comment, for the time to go back and forth. Those timelines are defined by the rule, and that's kind of the way that they're set up. So in terms of our speed and in terms of the level of complexity here, right now about 10% of our engineering staff is involved in actually doing this particular work. So, you know, to increase the amount of staffing, will it make it go faster? It will, but, you know, you're talking about significant cost there, right? The second thing is, when we say, and this is hard to explain, when we say a facility has five, you know, sources, that facility may also have 15, 20, 30, 50 compounds coming out of those five sources, all of which, you know, need to go through the reporting and sampling and emissions calculation process. Complex, complicated. We're at a level of health risk for existing facilities that's five times less than anybody else in the country. So, you know, it's complex, it's complicated. Could we do better on the timelines? I'm not going to tell you that with more staff we couldn't move faster. On the stuff that's written into the rules, we can definitely go back and look at that and see if there's a way that we can bring a rule amendment that shortens that, if that's what this committee wants to do. And, you know, we can discuss this internally and come back to you at your retreat and talk about a little bit about how we could close the time gap here.
One more item, Mr. Chair, thank you. So thank you for that, Damien. I would just suggest to the public and my colleagues, that was a very helpful answer. We passed a rule in 2017, and I think at that time, the most important thing for members of this board to do is look at the board, and we need to be more cognizant. If we want faster timelines, we need to put those things into our rules. So I would support a rule amendment if that's the most expedient thing to help the public's concern and to move along. And if staff feels that there's additional staffing needs, I would like to hear about that at the same time. Thank you.
Director Joya.
So I won't repeat. I think maybe what you're hearing here from the board is to, without figuring out where the time savings can occur here, is to come back with a plan that looks at how to move through this process as quickly as possible, and then come back with that. I want to understand the phase one facilities, which are the ones we're starting with, are the ones where the cancer prioritization score was greater than 250. Mm-hmm. Or non-cancer prioritization score of greater than 10, right? Mm-hmm. So, and because obviously there's a lot of interest in the large facilities. Which of the large facilities are right now in phase one, and where are they? You indicate here there's three HRAs that are underway. There's a preliminary HRA that is complete. Can you tell us actually also which ones those are? Yeah. So of the, there's a preliminary HRA complete for one facility. What, yep. Do you know the name of the facilities?
Yeah, Carol listed all those earlier. Okay. Let's go back through them again one more time.
Yeah, I just want to make sure in these categories.
Put on your microphone, Carol, if you don't mind.
Thank you.
I heard you say the cemetery, but I'm just trying, I didn't write them down.
So the facility that's complete is Irvington Memorial Cemetery. Right. And
they have a crematory, is that correct?
Yes, that's the crematory.
Got it.
And the next couple that are on the list.
The three that are underway?
It's
Owens Corning.
Yes.
Got it, okay, yeah.
Owens Corning and City of Santa Clara. Energy. And Los Medanos Energy Center.
Got it. That's a large.
Next three after that are FXI, Genentech, and AB&I, the foundry.
Got it. So where did the, because obviously a lot of interest in the refineries as well. The five refineries, where did they fall in terms of the risk category? The which phase and where are they?
All the refineries are in phase one.
Right.
There's a number of support facilities in there as well. There's some acid production plants.
Right.
And Air Liquide in that.
Right. Or the chemical plants. Right.
It's Corteva Agriscience. It used to be Dow Chemical is in there. Ball Metal.
So they're in either the validating data or validation complete.
They're in the validating data stage.
Right. Because. Mm-hmm. Got it. So, and just to understand for phase one, so the validate data here, it looks like goes through what you're showing, though, third quarter of 2020. So presumably many of the large facilities are in that category.
That's when we hope to have the information complete for the refineries.
And then the conducted preliminary HRIs, right, because they're starting earlier. Okay, I think I have a better understanding. So I just think really trying to come back with how we can expedite the time frame in a strategy that works. I know that when we passed it, I think we all thought it was being implemented sooner than it is, but I realize on the chart you've got classifying the facilities, validating data. I probably don't remember that it was going to take that long to validate the data. You may have talked about that, but I think in our discussions we may not have appreciated or understood the length of time to validate the data and figured that the rule would start, the implementation would start much sooner. That was at least, I think, the general understanding.
I think it's important that we bear in mind also that reductions are already happening at all of the facilities we're talking about. As they prepare to go into this process, they're already taking steps to reduce emissions because one way to solve their problem is to fall below the line when you get done with the preliminary analysis. So people are receiving the benefits of the rule, and they started receiving them actually before the rule was passed. We are aware of toxic risk reduction projects that have been underway at facilities all along. So the fact that the rule hasn't forced it in terms of a risk reduction plan does not mean that the rule did not affect toxic risk and have it already coming down. So just it's an important point to remember that having the rule in place at all has already forced some of those changes that we're expecting will play out.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
And I thank you for that, Mr. Bunger. Perhaps that could either be part of a next report, because that's good information that because the rule's been put in place, even though we have to go through some of these processes, as you say, sites want to get below that. So who started this process is now below, and how those benefits have been have impacted our communities. We need to know that information, and I appreciate the report you've given and where we are in the process, but let's get that information out also. Thank you.
And I wondered to the comment that we've slipped our timelines from a year ago or less than a year ago, can you comment? Have our timelines moved out? How many people do we have on this? How many people are we have we multiplied with the consultancy that we have, and is increased resource a possibility?
Yeah, and I do apologize for we always present the timeline and assume that we're tracking, but we are about, I would say, 6 to 8 months off of where we were originally. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we didn't discuss today was obviously the reason why the refineries were so late in this process is because of the litigation that occurred right under 1215. We knew that would cause a slippage in our timeline. Everything else is going kind of, where we thought it would be in the process itself. Relative to our staffing, I think I mentioned like 10% of our engineering staff, which is, that's a pretty...
How many people does that...
That's between 6 to 8, depending on what part of the process. And then by bringing the consultants on board, we're hoping to almost double that capacity so we can move faster, right?
Is it fair to say that our AB 617 work has taxed some of our resources?
AB 617, 1215, there is a long list of commitments and initiatives that are taxing our engineering staff. We are also constrained in our budgeting by the amount that we raise fees on these facilities. And we've been pretty constant, at a 6.5% rate on all of our facilities across the board. So those things in balance have impeded our ability to move faster in this area, I would say.
Yeah, well, obviously, in 2017... we had seen the whole process and the timelines, and we know they're long. We also know this is this regulation is, as you said, right, 5 times more stringent than
the closest
than South Coast, and more than that for the rest of the country.
At a minimum,
I guess, right?
Nobody else is doing what we're doing.
Nobody else.
So we are requiring things that other places are not, which just means. It takes a while to go implement this, and
so on
we'd
top
all
of,
like it to happen tomorrow, of course.
On top of this, you have our regulatory calendar and AB 617 processes in these communities,
right.
And this all three working together, we think, are getting the emissions reductions that you would want to see. I do think it's important that we come back and report out to you on some of the facilities that have actually fallen out of both phase one and phase two because of refinements in their inventory that we've been able to verify. Up until we adopted this rule, for a lot of these facilities, they went with factors and not source tests. And all of that is now being refined, so we're getting a better handle and a better picture on what we're actually dealing with.
Thank you. Could you just give us a brief idea of how information from 1215 informs the work that we'll do under this rule?
Yeah, so the information that's in our data bank currently is what the refineries have reported to us over a number of years. With the implementation of 1215, we've been able to refine that and move away from factors, emissions factors in many cases, to actually sampling at the facilities themselves. The inventories themselves are more detailed and tightened up. That and the combination of the information that Carol has asked them on this precise locations of emissions points, verified
within a large facility you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. So, as I'd mentioned to you earlier, the reason why emissions data and the locations are important is that the more accurate we can get the flow rates and the points of emissions means the more accurately we can judge the impacts on a person that is located directly adjacent to the nearest worker, nearest resident, right? And when you've got a big facility like Chevron, which is, a couple of thousand acres,
right.
The actual location of a specific tank or location of a specific diesel engine is important relative to its health risk on the community. That's
so some right near a fence line where there's adjacent people living
is going to have
more than something right on the water.
Exactly. Okay. Now, when you have a facility that large and you're talking about hundreds of compounds, maybe from one emissions point, the modeling and the level of data and information needs to be the volume and accuracy of it is quite significant. And we've moved in this process from hourly and daily data to by the minute data, right?
For the meteorological data that we use in the health risk assessment model, it does use minute by minute data. That's the latest procedure.
Yeah, so we are down to a level of granularity that no one else is at. And that's a huge volume of data.
Great. So can you just finally comment, my last question, on what, how you added Schnitzer Steel, how that came to be? And
yeah, go ahead.
We went through, the facility did some source testing in 2017 and 18 in response to some changes at the facility. And based on that source test data, we updated their emission calculations for the facility and found that indeed they were over a prioritization score of 250 based on this test data that was recently completed.
So through that test data, they're part of this program. But again, when we say that they're part of this program, that means that they're going to go through our screening process. They're already moving to address those emissions. They're putting scrubbers in place through our regular permitting process. And it's the same with a lot of these facilities. There are ongoing actions that will continue to control those emissions. It's just that now they're a part of this program while they've got those scores, and we're going to be even more stringent on them. So for Schnitzer Steel, by the time we get to the point where the HRA is done, some of the controls that will actually help them get below where the HRA puts them will actually be installed and hopefully operational.
Well, thank you. I think it's the consensus of the group that we'd love to see you come back and talk to us about what could be accelerated, if more resources could help. We'd love to understand more about facilities that have taken preemptive action. Really appreciate your report today, Carol, Pam, Damien, thank you. Anybody else? If not, we'll move on to agenda item 5, the odor attribution study in the South Bay. And thank you all.
So this presentation is on the odor attribution study in the South Bay. As you know, the South Bay, the Milpitas area, has a large amount of odor. At your December 4th board meeting, you authorized us to spend about $500,000 on an odor study, attribution study in that area. This study, you know, I view it as not just for Milpitas, although it is being conducted there. You know, a lot of this data can be used at other facilities if we can find markers, tracers, compounds. It'll be applicable to other sources in the Bay Area. So this is bigger than Milpitas, but we're focused on Milpitas at this particular point. So I'm going to introduce Jerry Bovee. He's a manager.
It's also a point to that some places in San Jose and also Fremont are impacted, right?
Yes, yes. Southern Fremont and northern San Jose. Right. We always call it the Milpitas area, but yeah, you are correct. So Jerry Bovee, source test manager in our M&M division, is going to give us a presentation, just give you some details on the odor study itself, what we're trying to achieve here. Go ahead, Jerry.
Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Chair Sinks and members of the committee. I'm happy and proud to be here to update you on the odor attribution study that we are planning for the South Bay. What I'm going to discuss is the waste facilities of interest in the Milpitas area, not to mention Fremont and San Jose, as you mentioned. A brief description of the South Bay Odor Stakeholders Group that was formed to discuss these issues, discuss what our goals are for the odor attribution study, and discuss the projects that we have selected and give you summaries of those, and the next steps that we are planning. This is a area overview, as many of you are already familiar with. San Jose, Milpitas, Fremont, where those cities come together. This yellow box, which is highlighted here, is our industry area of interest. It's where the facilities that we expect these orders to be coming from are actually located. If we do a blow up of that box, these facilities are International Waste Disposal Corp of California. That's the Newby Island landfill facility. Within that facility is the landfill, material recovery facility, and composting operation. In the green box is San Jose Santa Clara Regional Wastewater Facility. That houses a sewage treatment plant, sludge ponds, and drying beds, and not to mention anaerobic digestion processes. And the blue oval is Zero Waste Energy Development, where they do dry anaerobic digestion in facility or in vessel composting. Due to the long history of odor problems in the area, as many of you know, South Bay Odor Stakeholder Group was formed in 2015. It's composed of community members, industry representatives, and government officials.
Maybe you could put that back up for a second so we can all, because I was confused looking at
this one.
Thank you. Yeah. Now that has the circles on it. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I guess I missed the
So ZWAN is a small component of it, and those ponds at the bottom left are...
We were trying to pick them out there. But now
right,
yeah.
Right. Zero Waste is in the blue oval.
And the drying beds are sort of in the middle upper section of the green
yes,
circle,
you
right?
Yes, you can see them. They kind of look gray.
And after they dry out, then they're brought over to the landfill for...
Yes. That's my understanding.
Yes. So there's, not to steal your thunder, but there's a complex web of interactions between these facilities. Material is moving regularly between many of them.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
Okay, let's go on.
I'll try to remember.
We had to get the map, the geography right.
I'll make sure I click.
We're trying to organize a tour for this.
We have to control.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so the long history, as many of us know, due to that, the South Bay Odor Stakeholder Group was formed. It's composed of community members, industry representatives, and government staff, including the Air District and the city of Milpitas, where many of these odors are experienced. The group reviews the district actions that have been taken to date. And in 2019, it was identified that there was a need for a comprehensive odor study in order to get a handle on the issues in this area to see what could be done. So challenges on determining sources of odors. For the facilities, the proximity and similarity of these three facilities, it's difficult to trace odors back to specific facilities. These facilities all treat waste streams in different ways. The types of odor-causing compounds that are emitted are similar for all of the facilities. So tracking it to any specific facility becomes quite difficult. The processes that these facilities are actually implementing vary over time. Waste streams that enter the facilities will vary seasonally. Food waste or agricultural waste changes over time from season to season. The amount of that material that makes it to the facility will change. And consequently, so will the odor potential of these facilities. Your sensory ability to detect these odors, individuals, it can change with concentration and fatigue of your olfactory system. Longer you're exposed to an odor, the more your senses can be dulled to that odor. I've seen some studies that even say that certain types of odors can damage your olfactory system over time. So that complicates things greatly. The mineralogy of the area, the wind, temperature, humidity, seasonal fluctuations in those variables can play a great role in how these odors are experienced and detected. It affects the mixing and dilution of the compounds themselves within the ambient air. The concentrations change. It affects the transport characteristics. Where's the wind taking it? The technologies that have been used to date, although humans can detect smells at very low concentrations, a lot of the devices and analytical tools at our disposal cannot necessarily detect so well at those low concentrations. That's something that we're trying to change a bit with this study approach that we've come up with, so that we can try to get down into those lower ranges of detection that are more in line with what humans can detect with their noses. So, what questions are we trying to answer with this study? We're trying to find what is the contribution of odors from the three facilities, both individually and combined. Many of the compounds that could be emitted could mix in the atmosphere, giving a certain quality to the odor, or it could be from a particular source or from a particular process within an individual facility. We're trying to get at the root of that, to the root of that. What's the composition of the odors? What type of mix is present? You know, what is the individual ingredients that are contributing to the odors? For both all three of the facilities combined and for the individual facilities. How are the odors varying over time and space and with certain types of meteorology? We want to know how the concentrations at the fence lines of these facilities and within the communities are changing, and what ranges of these concentrations are actually of a level that is actually a nuisance level. What levels of the concentrations are people smelling, and what is considered something that is not such a big deal to the community out there? So the goals, we want to inform future actions to reduce these odors. We share the community's frustration in this. We want to get at the root of the cause of these odors so that we can do something about it. We want to identify best practices. We want to determine what enforcement tools we have at our disposal in order to deal with this. We want to determine what rules could be developed that would help us deal with these problems. We want to establish methods to monitor progress going forward, so that not only are we measuring the success of the odor reductions, but also we want to make sure that these odors are not going to be coming back, that it's long-term solutions as opposed to some short-term solution. We also want to educate the community, but more importantly, we want to learn from the community. They've been living with this for a very, very long time, and they have a lot to teach us in addition to information that we can share with them. In particular, you know, members of the South Bay Odor Stakeholder Group, we want to engage and we want to get their input on what we're doing. How are we going to achieve this? We've chosen two projects. Project one is with Montrose Environmental Group. It's a preliminary 1-month screening study to identify the compounds for further investigation. Montrose has the ability to measure and identify a wide range of compounds. They have a mobile platform that can be sent out to the area, moved around to different points along the fence line and within the community to measure certain odor-causing compounds. And they can measure at the part per trillion level in real time for many of these compounds, which is something that hasn't really been brought to a problem such as this before, at least to my knowledge. They use proton transfer reaction mass spectrometry, which is, I won't get into all that, Fourier transform infrared spectrometry and gas chromatography. The 1 month project is expected, it's a budget of $92,000 for that. And we expect that to feed in to the further work that's going to be done in the second project, which is Jacobs Engineering Group. They're going to be able to characterize the diurnal and seasonal odors. They're going to do focus field sampling and data collection, and they're going to do it over at least a minimum of 3 seasons. We might extend it to 4 in order to get the variability that I had discussed previously. The advantages of Jacobs, they have extensive experience and a very highly qualified professional team that they are bringing to bear on this problem for us. Their experience includes facilities of the type that we're talking about, landfills, wastewater treatment, composting. They understand the types of compounds that can be emitted from these facilities and the odors that these compounds can cause. They had a very, very well-defined approach and methodology that they had put together in their proposal. And they're very well-versed in public engagement communication so that they can be a partner with us in dealing with the public, talking to the public, educating the public, learning from the public. The methods that they're going to bring, odor compound identification, that's going to feed off of the work done by Montrose. They can model the odor releases so that we can do back trajectory analysis and figure out where the odors were coming from. They can develop the methods that we are going to need for ongoing performance at the facilities to reduce these odors. And again, they can help us engage with the public and are well-versed in describing the results to the public so that we can communicate back and forth and keep the interaction going. This project budget's $500,000. It was already approved by the full board, the funding. So how do these projects complement each other? Well, Montrose going out, they're gonna give us the low concentration baseline for a host of compounds that aren't causing odors and that are causing odors at very, very low detection levels, part per trillion, which, like I said, I don't know if we've actually brought to bear on a problem such as this before. They are going to be able to identify help Jacobs identify specific targeted odor markers, not to mention the actual odor-causing compounds themselves. Jacobs will then be able to work on the odor intensity and quality characterization, which is it putrescent? Is it rancid? Is it aromatic? You know. And then Jacobs will be able to use that information to attribute the odors to specific sources so that we can identify further actions. So next steps, we're going to finish the draft work plans that we are putting together with the vendors and provide those to the South Bay Odor Stakeholder Group to get their review and input. We're going to finalize these contracts with the vendors so that we can begin the process of launching these projects. And we're going to bring back periodic updates to the board committees and the community. And with that, I can take questions.
Director Wagon, connect.
Thank you. It is interesting to go into the nature of stink and how it plays out in different neighborhoods. But the question I have is the odors, are the odors, is there a are there health effects from these odors?
Many of the odor causing compounds themselves do not have adverse health effects. However, a few of them do in higher concentration,
yeah.
Such as hydrogen sulfide, very pungent, rotten egg smell. Mm-hmm. It's also toxic at high enough concentration. When we're dealing with odors, the human nose is so sensitive that typically the range of concentrations are much, much lower than what would be in that toxic concentration range. Now, that's not always 100% the case. We expect some co-benefit here because if we can identify source of odors, then we may also be able to, and reduce those. We might be able to actually reduce some toxic emissions as well, although, they're not that high.
Thank you.
So if I can add.
Yes,
please. In addition to specific health effects, such as hydrogen sulfide has the capacity to cause you to pass out and can kill you. But
that sounds pretty negative. Yeah.
It's pretty, it's deadly. But below, there's different health effects from different compounds, but in general, odors are noted to, like, experiencing unpleasant odors over a prolonged period of time can cause a high stress level, anxiety, depression, which can lead to inflammation, just generalized. Mm-hmm. And so it is considered unhealthy to have to experience odors over a prolonged period of time.
Good point.
I just want to add that when you're talking about hydrogen sulfide gas, the health effects are really felt at the part per million range. Odor thresholds in the part per billion range, like 1-2 part per billion, you can smell it. The really low part per billion doesn't really have a notable, really adverse health effect until the part per million range. And we're looking in the part per billion, part per trillion range for this particular compound. So really just to give you some scale of what we're looking
diffuse.
For.
I guess my point with this, and it's kind of going bleeding back into the last discussion, is we've got a lot of things going on, and I get nervous about any time that we could have this place packed with people coming down and telling us that, and we did have it packed, and when we were in Milpitas, coming down and telling us about the nature of the stink in their area. And we could decide to throw huge amounts of resources towards that, but we're not really affecting the health, and other than that you're not feeling, you're not smelling that. What if we're going to be talking about putting more resources into 1118, I would like to have that put in a context with what are we doing, and where are we going to get the biggest bang for the buck? If 1118 is the most logical spot to put a lot more resources to get that moving, I'm happy to do that, or I'm maybe not happy to do that, but I could manage to do that. But if really 617 is going to be the bigger bang for the human lungs benefit, I want to put my money in towards that. And if I have to let 1118 slide a little bit because that's just the nature of the beast, I want to know that, and I want to look at that. I don't want to look at 1118 without the context. And yeah. I don't want to look at this without the context. So it'd be nice to get all of our rules, and what are we working on, and which is going to have the biggest bang for the buck.
Well, in terms of this particular problem, we, as Jerry said, some of the technology has moved, and it gives us the ability that we haven't had before. We're hoping it gives us the ability to be able to say the odors from this particular facility, because we've got now tracer gases at really low levels. We'd say the odor is from this facility, or it's from this facility or the other one. And then it becomes, rather than them all pointing the finger at each other, it becomes easier for us then to adopt a command and control approach. And that's why the study, it makes sense for us that the resources really are, you know, being added by these consultants, and we hope in the end that we'll be able to get something that we manage efficiently. So this is something that I think is very important to us, and it's an area that we do want to concentrate on this year.
Yeah. And I'm not taking away from that. I think this is very appropriate to work in, especially if I've been living in that area that has had great effect on my living for a long time. This is something we should be working on over the time, and this sounds like we have the method to do that. Yeah. But I'm just talking in more broad sure. sense. I want to have health effects and CO2 additions and those types of things, right? Bringing the areas that we're investigating and spending more money on higher. At that point, I like what we're doing here, and it looks like we're going to come up with some good answers for these poor folks that have been living with this for a long time.
That's our goal.
Thank you,
Director Canepa.
Thank you very much. Just a couple questions. The first is, how long has this been a problem for? Because there seems to be with these waste facilities, like a cauldron of odor. It seems like there's several sources. So how long has this been going on for?
Well, that area has been a landfill for decades. I lived in the Bay Area my entire life, and it's always been a landfill. That's the Newby Island portion. It had a different name back then, but that's been there a long time. Some of the parts of this facility are a little newer, like the ZWED facility is 3 years or so old, I think, at this point, something like that. So that's a new technology coming online. Also, some of the operations have shifted over time, so there's composting operations that are different than they were even a few years ago with the waste diversion. And the way the wastewater treatment plant operates is different today than it was in the past. So there's a variety of long existing and newer and changing operations.
Yeah, and I think we expect that to change in the future too with the state's waste diversion goals. The other thing that, you know, over time, there's been people moving in closer and closer. So we have businesses and residents all moving closer to these facilities. So that is another issue. And the fact that these facilities are in San Jose and that some of the, and you know, odors don't stop at borders. So it goes across to the other cities and counties.
So, you know, I think it's great. We have this odor attribution study, right? We're trying to identify sort of where the issues and problems are, right? So I guess my question to you is, we're able to identify where these issues are. The question is it solvable? So I think residents, people who live in that area, me in particular, where I live, just by my house, as you drive by Westlake, we're dealing with the issues around the anaerobic digester. It's been, you know, had a foul odor. What are the expectations? We go through the study, we identify what the issues are, right? Are we going to be able to solve the odor problem in its totality?
Well, that's a really good question.
I think it's a great question.
The answer to that is that the information that we're going to get from this is going to inform us and educate us on where the specific odors are coming from. The items that are within our authority, then yeah, we can do something about it. And we'll try to develop the policies and what we need to have in place to do that. For the items that aren't within our authority, it'll give us the information that we need to work with our agency partners, our government partners, in order to address it so that we can work in partnership to actually come to some resolution. Now, whether in the long term all the odors are going away, that's not a question I can answer right now for you.
So let me ask you real quick. So what you do have authority over is You don't have authority over the San Jose, Santa Clara Regional Wastewater Facility. Is that correct?
No. Or do you? We have permit authority over the sources within that facility.
Okay. Zero Waste Energy Development?
Yes.
Okay. And then, Newbie Island?
Yes.
Yes.
Perfect.
Okay, so then what don't you have? You just said you didn't have authority in other areas. What are those areas?
Composting operations aren't subject to odor nuisance regulation. We regulate composting operations through process controls and that sort of thing. And we've been, you know, you guys have heard before, but you will hear again. We're bringing a series of rules related to organics and methane and those sort of operations in the coming months. Those will address some of the issues. But we have, so it's not odor nuisance per se, but they do have emissions of methane and other pollutants, and so we control those through permitting and through rulemaking.
Got it. One last question. Have there been fines issued to any of these agencies to date?
Yes, there have been some notice of violation issued in the past few years, and there have been resolutions of some of those. I think they were may have been reported in some recent board packets.
Yeah, I think that as we have been working the situation, we've solved certain issues. But there are, you know, layering of odors in this area. So if you solve one, there's another one sort of rises to the surface. So the attempt here is to get to all of them at the same time. And the other thing I think I wanted to address in Director Wagenknecht's questions was that, you know, this particular odor study gets to compounds. It also, you know, we have we just talked about 1118. Landfills are on that list as far as toxics and health risk assessments. And then also we have the climate and organics rules that are coming forward that these facilities are subject to or will be subject to. So all this emission data will go into that to try and reduce emissions from these facilities and reduce odors also from these facilities. So I think it's a pretty comprehensive program that we have developed for this whole area.
Again, I think it's great that we're trying to identify these different sources, but I just hope in general that the public sort of understands that, you know, there may not be a solution in its totality to remove all odors. Does that make sense? That's just the reality of it. It's like exactly where I live. You know, it's next to a sanitation, you know, next to a sanitation department. Neighbors come up, they voice their opinion, but this may be one of those issues that is not solvable. And I think staff, I don't know, yeah.
Absolutely, and I think that, but the information we will get from the study is the level of the compounds that are there, and that maybe we can say not toxic or not health effects, those sorts of things that we could say. You may smell it, but it may not be toxic.
Well, I'd like to add some perspective to this. I am a Cities Association of Santa Clara County delegate to this body, appointed by all of them, and Milpitas has long been plagued. I mean, I remember coming to graduate school in 1980 and driving by the facilities in the South Bay, whether to go backpacking in Yosemite or skiing in Tahoe, and you know, it seems like we ought to be able to do better. We know that in addition to the odors, that there's quite a bit of methane emitted, and we all have a concern for climate reasons about doing better. It's also been said that given state's diversion goals, we have some 15 more facilities to be sited that could be primarily composting facilities. We know the Bay Area is growing. How do we put, if this is a prototypical facility that has a set of facilities that has big issues, I think there are questions that ought to be answered here. So how do we accommodate facilities in our communities in a way that doesn't create conflicts? And as you say, maybe some of them are inevitable, but I'm quite convinced, listening to folks from industry, from ecology and others, that there are a number of facilities in the Bay Area operating with less impact and just as close to their communities as this set of facilities. So I think some of you in previous meetings have talked about that. So I think we ought to get good at trying to help resolve the conflicts, enforce what we can, get more rules to deal with situations. I mean, I've heard some pretty amazing stories. You talk to the vendors that operate these facilities on behalf of San Jose, or as their, you know, as their chief customer. I hear stories about how, you know, the product we're getting at the input to ZWET is completely tainted, and that by contract they're supposed to be doing this to us, but they're not. And so piles sit outside rotting, right? And they go anaerobic. And one of my questions is, how do we make sure during the approximate year of this study that people knowing that they're being scrutinized clean up their act, and the following year they go right back to what they were doing before? Do we have any surveillance, any cameras or other things, if we know that we've had these piles sitting around that...
It's a good point, Director Sinks. One of the goals of these, as I mentioned, is to develop ongoing monitoring strategies so that we know in the future that any reductions or any outcome from this in odor reduction can be monitored in the future, and we can make sure that these are ongoing results and not just one-time results. And quite frankly, if they clean up their act a little bit during the study, it may be more difficult to identify who was a bad player, but if we put the monitoring in place to make sure that they stay clean...
That would be ongoing monitoring.
Ongoing monitoring, yeah. Then they will know that they're actually being watched. Yeah.
So if this establishes a baseline and they're deliberately cleaning up and they're below that baseline, they're at the low level, it doesn't go up anymore.
It doesn't really work so well.
The other thing is, I think you have to be conscious of just the sheer volume that these facilities are dealing with, and them trying to game the system is going to be pretty difficult.
Okay. Yeah, and also I just want to point out that, you know, along with this identifying the compounds, you know, there's all this new sensor technology that's taking place, and it's much easier to design a sensor for a specific compound for certain levels so that you can develop that technology a bit more if you know what you're trying to measure. So those things can all be leveraged in this case, hopefully in the future.
Yeah, well, I appreciate everybody's comments and your work, and I would just say that the enforcement side is of concern. San Jose is the LEA, the enforcement agency, right? And so it's been frankly tough for Air District staff to pass data onto them and then have them enforce for the compost. And we've Jack and Wayne and I had a conversation recently with a senior person at CalRecycle, and we are working to see what we could do to perhaps reach some agreement that would allow our staff to write violations that the LEA then would take, basically, and enforce more expeditiously. So we'll see. I don't know exactly what that'll look like. We'll have to have those conversations with the San Jose LEA and see if we can reach some agreement. But we're interested in making sure that we... once we know what the issues are, we have the tools and agreements to make things better. Director Mitchoff.
Thank you. On that last slide, number 12, what we're looking at, and I'm sorry if I missed it, finalizing contracts and launching projects, are we looking by the end of the year, at middle of January? What's the finalizing contracts time frame?
I'm hoping to have it by the middle of January, and there's a South Bay Odor Stakeholder Group meeting in January as well, where we can present the work plan to them so that we can get their review and comment on it as well.
So once the contract is finalized, there still needs to be input before they can launch the project?
The work plan itself, it's a draft work plan, but it's something that we expect to evolve a little bit as we're learning things over the year. So we
so
want
the
to
work
get,
can begin, is my
right, point. Work can begin, and then we can just get their input.
Okay.
Yeah, we're also, we're just asking for input from the stakeholders group. These are, you know, this consists of industry and government who have some stake in it. And they have some definite views on how this should be done.
And that's
why we're
doing it. I don't want to wait for that before stuff gets going. The periodic status report, could we have that every quarter, please? Thank you.
Great. I appreciate staff's work on this. And, you know, we're all going to we all have produced waste, and we're all going to have to be thoughtful about how we meet our diversion goals. What happens with sea level rise for some of these facilities sitting right on the bay, right? We don't need to go there, I guess. But the work that we're doing, I think, will inform how we deal with these conflicts in other places in the Bay Area. So thank you, Jerry.
I do have one speaker, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you do? I'm sorry.
Stacy Randecker.
Thank you. Sorry about that. The long way.
The long, slow
way. Yep.
She needs walk-up music.
I don't know.
Hi. This is my first meeting here. I am a co-cyclist with Mr. Bowders. And I was surprised to see this on the agenda. It's like, oh my gosh, I actually know this. I used to work in Milpitas. And I biked there from Caltrain. And it's awful. And I'm sure you've heard that plenty from the people who live there and have to deal with it every day. I don't know all the measures and numbers that you were talking about and referring to in terms of balancing the different commitments that you need to make and issues that you're facing, but we just need more. I mean, I don't know where you need to go get the money from, but we need to reduce emissions, and we need to, you know, let people have a better quality of life. I mean, does it cause cancer? Probably not. I don't know. I have no idea. But I do know that the quality of life and is awful. I accepted a job in Santa Clara, and then they moved a few months later to Milpitas, and I have lived in the Bay Area. At that point, it was almost 19 years. I had never been to Milpitas, and now I know why, because it frankly stinks. And so the notion that, oh my God, people live here, like, it's awful. So yes, please, whatever you can do to get more funding so that we can reduce emissions, so that we don't burn the planet, but also allow people to live in more densely populated areas without suffering the ill effects of, you know, what we do as humans for industry and life, etc. So yes, I would encourage you to grow your pie rather than having to make trade-offs between these important issues. Thanks.
Anybody else? Thank you so much. And with that, we move to public comment on non-agenda matters. Are there any cards? No? Thank you. Committee member comments? Seeing none, the time and place of our next meeting will be at the call of the chair. And we stand adjourned. Probably not.